ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/imagine. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. On this episode, Scott Lasser asks us to say nice things about Detroit. Don Swayze talks about his upcoming Western, Heathens and Thieves. And one of our show's biggest fans in Europe has an audiobook available from Blackstone. Right after the news you want to know. Hello, I'm Cyrus Emerson.
And I'm Charlie Stanton.
And I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Beyoncé and Jay-Z sure know how to spend a holiday weekend. The A-list couple spent Labor Day weekend in Philadelphia, where they attended the Made in America Festival. When Jay-Z wasn't on stage performing for the roaring crowd, he headlined the two-day fest, he was backstage by his wife's side, where they hung out with pals. Construction of stages and tents began in late August at the somewhat unusual venue, a tree-lined boulevard in the heart of downtown Philly.
How cool would that be? Have you been to Philadelphia?
I have, because I actually went to college at Swarthmore College, which is right outside of Philly.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I imagine that tree-lined, way to the concert. You can just hear all the cars bouncing up and down, rap music.
Yeah, and actually they went through special efforts to make sure that no one was able to sneak into the concert. And they had
99 problems, but sneaking in isn't one?
That's right. Concerts were held on three different stages, one of them being near the Philadelphia Museum of Art's steps. And that was actually made famous by Sylvester Stallone in the film Rocky.
You know, they still have a statue of me up there. Oh, no, wait a minute. I think that's Rocky.
Is that why everyone asks for your autograph?
You know what? I used to think everyone was asking for my autograph, but then it just kind of dawned on me. Everyone that's asking for my autograph is, wearing a uniform with a badge. And they're going, hey, can you sign this? Yeah. Next time, slow it down on the tree lane on the highway there.
It happens to look like a cop.
Yeah.
Jay-Z's first surprise was a video from President Obama, who voiced his support of Made in America's patriotic vision and urged concertgoers to register to vote, a call to action greeted with cheers. Woohoo!
Yeah, on to the next one.
Jay-Z issued a proclamation. Since you treated me so well, I'm a be good to you, Philly. A few minutes later...
That sounded just like him. I could have sworn Cyrus, couldn't you have sworn that Jay-Z was in here?
I think so, yeah. Maya should be a rapper, too.
Yeah, she should. It's not on par with your rapping.
That's your job, Cyrus. I think you're...
When are you going to start that rapping tour for the fall?
As soon as I get my cornrows again.
Oh, okay.
He's still working on it. All right. A few minutes later, a handful of surprise guests trotted onto the stage, including rappers 2 Chainz, Common, and Kanye West. Jay-Z took the stage again Sunday night, where he joined Pearl Jam to perform 99 Problems.
Pearl Jam to a 99 Problems? Oh, my God.
Just like, so you were psychic there. For those of you who didn't make it to the festival, don't worry. Filmmaker Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, who did A Beautiful Mind and The Da Vinci Code, will be directing a movie about the show. The pair's 2000 movie was American Gangster, about a notorious Harlem drug lord, and it was inspired by Jay-Z's album by the same name. The new one will be sort of a sequel to Jay-Z's fade to black, and we'll focus on how Jay-Z put the Made in America show together.
How cool is that? Is his new album going to be like, you know, a Canadian gangster? Or, you know, we moved up north.
Hey, that
like Justin
happen.
Bieber, right?
He went up there with the Bieber. And the Bieber, he's so popular. He's just like, yeah, I got to do something, you know.
It'd be interesting to see them collaborate.
You know, they might. I mean, he collaborates with Usher.
Wow, Ron Howard working on this is going to make this a pretty big project. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. You know, oh, sorry about that, Maya. Yeah, Ron Howard, he's up there with Steven Spielberg. You know, he did like a Feel Good Man, and he was Opie.
Has he won any Academy Awards?
No, but he was on Happy Days, and that's like the equivalent to an Academy Award. I don't think
that'll
you
make
know
you
what?
Just as happy as winning an Academy Award.
I don't know
award.
If he won an Academy Award. I think he was nominated for the Da Vinci Code.
Mm. Another good movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, anytime you worked with Tom Hanks, you know, you're almost guaranteed to win an Oscar.
They'll be on internet too, right?
I hope so. Yeah, since we didn't get a chance to go to Philly for the festival, we'll get a chance to experience it through the movie. It sounds like
nice.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to that. And, you know, speaking of looking forward to films, in that I just recently watched this show like two nights ago, Anger Management, the new Charlie Sheen show. And it is getting, you know, getting so good. In the beginning, it was a little shaky, you know, and it's like, you know, is it going to have like, you know, a familiar cast of characters? And they keep bringing the same people back. And then the episode I happened to catch was the one where Charlie Sheen's dad comes to visit him, and he plays this psychiatrist, right? And his dad was Martin Sheen, his real dad. And it was really, it was hysterical. So you can easily see why FX has ordered 90 more episodes of Anger Management, Charlie Sheen's TV comeback vehicle, after he was so notoriously fired from 2 and a Half Men. The unusually large order reflects the original agreement that FX made for the sitcom that stars Sheen as his therapist. As part of the deal, FX set a ratings target for 8 of the first 10 episodes of Anger Management. The show reached the threshold, earning an automated 90-episode order. That's a round figure of like 100 episodes, which is really kind of unheard of. Anger Management will go into syndication in September 2014, the company said Wednesday. It's a model used with the Ice Cube sitcom, Are We There Yet? FX called Anger Management the cable's highest-rated new comedy series this year, averaging 4.5 million total viewers.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and that's amazing because it's a cable show.
Yeah. Well, you know, Charlie Sheen, he's a movie star, so he brings box office to cable, I guess.
Yeah, you know what? He's like the phoenix, man. The guy keeps rising from the ashes, you know?
What's that word he always uses? Or Hugo?
Winning.
Winning. See, there you go.
Everybody's
winning.
A winner.
Yeah, you know, I saw him on some talk show, and they were talking about it, and I think it was Jay Leno or David Leno. One of them said winning to him, and he goes, well, we don't say that anymore.
I wonder, what's his new word then?
I don't know, and I don't even know if he's still drinking tiger blood or vampire blood or whatever it was. Whatever he's doing it very well.
It works, yeah.
He came back.
Well, there's another winner. For your iPhone, iPad, and Android, you can get Seinfeld's new series, Comedians and Cars Getting Coffee.
Love that show, dude. It is so good.
You've seen it?
I saw it with Cyrus. It was so funny.
It was. It looks like something Charlie should go on.
It's
perfect for Charlie.
Jerry, give me a call, dude. I love coffee.
Yeah, you guys can drive down to Dutch Brothers or something.
Well, you know, I think we'd have to go to New York to do that because, you know, anywhere you drive in Ashland to get coffee, I mean, what? It's going to take you 2 minutes to get there.
Your bike.
Yeah.
Well, if I could get my Model A fixed up, you could take that, and it would probably take you a half hour to get there.
We could be. Yeah.
And you could wave at the window in a parade.
Exactly.
Well, you know what? If we had Jerry Seinfeld driving in Cyrus's Model A, believe me, there'd be a crowd there we could wave to.
Yeah, some people would be definitely filming that one.
Maybe it would get on the internet. You could put it. Yeah, well, it would be. It would be on a Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee on your Crackle app, which you can get for free on iOS and Android. And there's also a huge selection of movies, including Monty Python's and Now for Something Completely Different, The Fifth Element, and Groundhog Day, as well as TV shows like All in the Family, Barney Miller, and of course, Seinfeld. So, you know, go out there, get that Crackle app, and check out Charlie on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Yeah, I would love to. I hope that comes to fruition. It would be great. Maya, you know what? You should check out this Crackle app because it's really, here's the thing that's, okay. I think is going to be really cool with them. It's like they're showing movies and they're showing television, which a lot of people do. But when we saw them, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, It was part of the original series. And then you've got a big guy like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, and they have a lot of other big names too. And they have, they do original material.
That sounds really
great. They have new shows. And they're all like short films.
Yeah, like the one with Alec Baldwin, that was hilarious.
Yeah, it was hysterical. But that's the one we watched, the one with Alec Baldwin. And you know what? And I've got to say this for the record. As much as I love Jerry Seinfeld, Alec Baldwin was actually funnier than Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh, wow. That's saying something.
Yeah. Seinfeld asked him a question to start off their conversation. He says, who do you think's worked harder in their career, you or me? And Baldwin says, well, you know, Jerry, I definitely think that I've worked harder than you, but I haven't gotten as far as you.
Oh, boy.
And it started the whole thing off, and it was just hysterical. I went to a restaurant, and he did Jack Nicholson impersonations, and the whole thing was great.
Listeners will have to watch that. I think they're hooked now.
You know, hey, you know, speaking of original material, you know, the Crackle thing with Jerry Seinfeld was great, and then I was, you know, actually just blown away by this story. I saw this guy on David Letterman. Rodriguez is his name, and the story is just like, it's just unbelievable. It's so cool, and it actually is true. I mean, yeah. Maya's going to tell us all about it.
Yeah, one of the most interesting documentaries in the music forte this year is certainly this film, Searching for Sugar Man. It probes deep inside the mysterious 70s rocker, Sixta Rodriguez, known for his songs Sugar Man and Crucify Your Mind. This folk rock musician released the album Cold Fact in 1970, followed by Coming From Reality the following year. While not easily recognized here in the United States, in South Africa, Rodriguez was bigger than Elvis. There, his music became the soundtrack for protest and rebellion in the repressive society of racial segregation. And without even knowing it, Rodriguez seemed to be a Bob Dylan meets Cat Stevens for the anti-apartheid movement. Searching for Sugar Man chronicles his South African fans' long and complicated quest to determine whether Rodriguez had really committed suicide on stage, since there were rumors of him shooting himself in the head as well as lighting himself on fire. Luckily, Rodriguez had done neither. Instead, he had faded back into obscurity in his hometown of Detroit. The man never saw any royalties before 1998 on any of his music. The film's tale of the rise and fall and rise again of this musician actually mirror the journey of the film's director, Malik Bindeleul. He nearly went broke making the movie until he got a grant from the Swedish Film Council and Sony Classics picked it up. That similarity to Rodriguez's career, although it was, you know, 30 years later, makes this film something special. And for record collectors, you may find a special spot in your heart, as well as your turntable, for this obscure giant. Really, this one-of-a-kind human interest story is not something you read about or see every day. Quite interesting.
You know, it's, I've heard his music. He is really good. And, you know, it's kind of, I would encourage all the listeners to go to YouTube or wherever you, you know, Vimeo, wherever you get your video content, or maybe Crackle. And, you know, you listen to him, and he's a good artist, and the immediate thought I had was like, well, he sounds a lot like Bob Dylan. But then if you put it into contents, man, he was sounding like Bob Dylan before Bob Dylan was doing this.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and he did it in a different continent, different culture, and he was the soundtrack for the 60s and 70s of South Africa. And he came from right here in you know, the Motor City.
Huh.
How cool is that?
I'm surprised he didn't catch on in the United States.
You know, he was like an artist, and I've often said this to Cyrus. It's like he's the type of artist that he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it to perform. And if you listen to his music, that was cool too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't even collect his royalties. He just went back to Detroit and said, I'm done.
In Detroit, he was actually doing interesting things. He was doing demolition work and forms of manual labor. He just kind of
faded. You know, he did go on the David Letterman show when this film first broke, and you know, David Letterman asked him, well, why didn't you stay in Detroit? I mean, did people listen to your record? And he said, I think 7 people bought my record in off the Motown label. His mom and him were probably 2 of them.
Wow. Yeah, people love those stories. I mean, it's like the Fountainhead or something.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Yeah, that's a good correlation. You like that $50 word?
Another group of guys that were in obscurity until recently, Jason Baldwin, Damian Echols, and Jesse Miskelly, also known as the West Memphis Three, are out of prison after nearly two decades.
Yeah, hallelujah for that, man.
Yeah, it's been a huge media sensation. We've covered it on our show. They were convicted as teenagers in 1993 for the murders of three Cub Scouts in eastern Arkansas. And after years of questions about the evidence in the case and attention from such celebrities as Pearl Jam frontman Eddie Vedder and the Dixie Chicks Natalie Maines, now they are trying to move forward while dealing with a new world of iPhones and Twitter.
You know, how crazy is that? Because, you know, they were in prison for, what, 17 years, something like that?
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole world, I mean, it's just turned
totally
upside
different.
Totally changed, yeah. The Super Nintendo, they said, was the latest in technology when they went into prison.
The world would seem pretty different with everything that we now just take for granted.
So, yeah, they're trying to get used to it. Also, they're trying to get used to the idea of being celebrities because, I mean, yeah, it's been such a huge thing in the media with the books and all that. Although Ms. Kelly has been eking out a quiet life in a trailer park near where he grew up in West Memphis, Baldwin spent time on a set of Devil's Knot, an upcoming movie about the case starring Reese Witherspoon, the book now Blackstone, Devil's Knot, and Eccles is preparing to crisscross the country to promote his new book, Life After Death.
You know, I want to read that book, and I know that there was a lot of interest in it. Devil's Knot, I can't wait. I've read the book, actually read the book, and heard the book, too, on Blackstone's audio.
What did you think?
Oh, it was great. It was great. I mean, it was so good. It was also a little bittersweet because, you know, all this, murder, mayhem, this gut-wrenching, the suspense, these celebrities, this whole phenomenon of the West Memphis Three was actually true. You know, when we think about it, you know, the tragedies, you know, those little boys lost their lives, and these men were falsely imprisoned for all their youth, and the killer's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so hopefully they bring that case, gets brought to fruition. But the Damien Eccles, I knew he was writing a book, because I had corresponded with him, and I can't wait to see Devil's Knot, the movie, because it's Reese Witherspoon and Colin Firth is the lead actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Johnny Depp is going to be involved in it too, and which would be something that, I mean, he could only play Damien Eccles. He used to visit Damien Eccles in prison. He was one of the key players in getting him out.
So he has a sense of who this guy is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Could be a blockbuster.
It would. Prison blockbuster.
You know, there are some artists who have been blockbusters for centuries, and Rembrandt is one of them.
He certainly is.
He is, yeah. And a Norwegian art gallery lost a Rembrandt etching in the mail. It was worth up to $8,600 after trying to save money on courier and insurance costs. The Solibrug Gallery in Graker, which is about 80 kilometers south of Oslo, purchased a copy of Rembrandt's Leven Willemsch van Kopenol Writing Master. It was originally created around 1658.
1658?
You were just a little baby then.
Oh, shut the front door.
He is older than dirt.
I was in the first grade.
Oh, see, okay. You were mature by then.
Yeah, I started growing my beard back then.
The gallery bought it from a British dealer, only to have it lost in the Norwegian postal system. Ole Derje, the gallery's chairman, said, "Using a courier or special insurance is quite expensive, so we have used regular mail until now. It is worth around 40,000 to 50,000 crowns, which, by the way, is about $6,900 to $8,600 in U.S. currency.
Wow, I gotta move to Norway, man.
And the Postal Service is actually only offering a compensation of 500 to 1,000 crowns, quite a bit less than the worth of it. Derje said his gallery, which is displaying works by many renowned artists, such as Goya and Dali, received notice to pick up the package, but when he went to collect it, it was nowhere to be found. He declined to name the seller, citing confidentiality concerns. In response, a spokesman for the Postal Service said, "We are sorry that this has happened. We have advised him to use a more appropriate form of mail when sending items that are worth as much as this, with the appropriate insurance connected." Well, I sure wish I would get that in the mail. Maybe it went to the wrong address. Hey, I'm going to keep looking on my doorstep.
Yeah, that'd be cool to get a Rembrandt in the mail. And another woman, Jennifer, ended up with a surprise $20,000 gift in the mail. That's what happened last month when Jennifer guided Ty Warner when he stopped and asked for driving directions in Santa Barbara, California. While Warner didn't know exactly how to get where he was going, Jennifer didn't realize who she was helping. Warner is the billionaire founder of Tai Inc., the Beanie Baby company.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Huh. Jennifer was at the intersection trying to raise $20,000 for a stem cell procedure she needs to help save her life because she suffers from kidney failure and does not qualify for a transplant. After I serendipitously met Jennifer, I further educated myself on her stem cell needs. I was shocked that this particular type of treatment wasn't available to her in the U.S., said Warner in a media release. My hope is that we can bring this life-saving treatment to the forefront so that it can become more readily available and provide alternatives for people like Jennifer. So the chance meeting allowed both Warner and Jennifer to each continue on their journeys through life.
You know, that's just a cool story, and it's, feel good, you know, and I was, did a little more research on that, and I was like, you know, how do these people even meet? And she said, you know, that she often gets asked by random strangers for directions while she's out there trying to raise money for her stem cell transplant. And she wasn't one to miss an opportunity. And he had pulled up, Ty Warner, and unbeknownst to her, he was the billionaire. And he asked for directions, and she gave them to him. And, you know, he handed her a $50 bill for a donation. And she just thought, well, that's the end of it. And then, you know, to put it in her own words, he returned an hour or so later. He rolled down his window. He reached out his hand and introduced himself, and then she immediately recognized his name. He was kind and sincere as he looked directly into her eyes, and he listened to her repeat her story over again. And he said, you know what, I'm going to send you a check, and you won't have to, you know, do this any longer. And he was true to his word, and he sent her a package on July 16th with a $20,000 check in it, with a handwritten note from him, and the note read, "Someone up there loves you because I was guided to meet you Saturday. I never lose my way, but fate had me lost. And I asked you for directions. The rest of the story, I hope, will be a wonderful new life for you." I mean, how cool is that?
That's so sweet.
Definitely, yeah. It's a tearjerker.
I knew you couldn't resist.
Those random definitely. Acts of kindness.
Yep, I had to throw it in there. You got me, Charlie.
I like it. I like great. It. Yeah. Well, no, you know what? Yeah, honestly, that's like the kind of stuff they make, you know, Hollywood movies out of.
Sounds like that could be Ron Howard's next movie.
It could very be. You know, I was a teenage Beanie Baby. You know,
and you still have your collection lined up on your windowsill. I saw them.
I you know what I do. You know, and wasn't there a Bill Clinton Beanie Baby? I mean, there wasn't. There should have been one.
There should have been.
Yeah, and a Hillary one as well. I mean, equal time. But you know, when you're Bill Clinton, you really don't need a script because you know. I don't know if you guys watched the Democratic National Convention. But the former president electrified the Democratic Convention with an impassioned defense for President Barack Obama. And we don't want to take sides here, but I'm going to tell you, this guy, Clinton, when I saw this speech, he gave the message to reelect Barack Obama better than Barack Obama did. I mean, you know,
wow,
he just
powerful.
Is.
Powerful.
Yeah. I mean, he had a 48-minute address that was classic Clinton. You know, it was folksy, it was funny, and at times it was professorial. You know, this is nothing new for Bill Clinton. He likes to wing his speeches. And it's funny because I did hear a critique of his speech from Hillary Clinton.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She said, you know, Bill read the speech to me, practiced on her, and she said he cut it down to like, you know, 2,000 words. And she goes, then I watched it live. And she was in Europe meeting the prime minister. So she watched it on TV and... he just winged it, and the dude went on for like almost 6,000 words.
He kept going. That's what I heard,
well,
too.
Well, you know, y'all just came out here to book Barack Obama. But
He likes to pontificate. Yeah, it's worth it.
He was famous for the speech he did for Dukakis back in 88. He went on for half hour, 45 minutes. People were yawning and cheered when he finally came to a finish.
You know, and that is so cool, Si. I'm glad you brought that up because... you know, he did that speech. And he was relatively unknown at the time, you know, governor from Arkansas. And then when he got nominated for president in 92, first thing he said when he got up there is, "I just want to finish that speech I started in 88. Y'all remember how it went." You know?
That got a good laugh.
I mean, the thing about Clinton is that he's just the kind of guy that, you know, makes you feel like you're the only person in the room.
Yeah.
And when he speaks, even though he's a Rhodes Scholar, like one of the, you know, very, very most intelligent politicians we've elected in a long time, he explains things to you and tells you and speaks in a common way that everyone can understand it.
Yeah, down to earth. And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature.
Destiny is a rising sun.
Oh. Don Swayze's latest role in Heathens and Thieves, a traditional Western heist film, takes on the larger social-political theme of Chinese immigration. He talked with us about the film, his role on True Blood, and a few happy stories about his big brother, Patrick Swayze.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we're privileged to have on Don Swayze.
Hey.
Hey, Don. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Of course, everybody knows you from your movies and all your different television shows. You've been on a lot of different TV shows. And
I've been kicking it around for a while, yeah.
But you have a new movie out, and it's called Heathens and Thieves. And, you know, I have only seen, you know, the trailers from it. But everyone I've talked to has said that it was just an amazing film. And what I saw was just so well, you know, directed and produced, and your acting was great.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very proud of it. I've done two Westerns over the past 3 years, but I was really fortunate to be offered a job like this during a time. It was pretty a difficult time. I was losing my big brother through the whole thing. But hey, you know, Patrick was a cowboy, and in a way, it was my way of honoring him. I was like, you know, I had to get back on the proverbial saddle myself after he passed away, and it just turned out 2 weeks later I was on a horse. 2 weeks after he passed away, on a horse with a gun strapped on me, and so anyway, I pretty much had him looking over me through the whole production.
I'm sure he was very proud of you. You know, and
thank you very much.
Yeah, and the finished product is, you know, is great. You know, for everyone out there listening, your older brother was Patrick Swayze, the huge, huge movie star.
Yeah. He was a big star growing up. He was a star in high school, and he in New York. He was a big ballet star at Joffrey Ballet, and then he went on and he took over as Danny Zuko in Grease on Broadway, and so he was a Broadway star. And then he came out to L.A. and within weeks he did one of the best MASH episodes ever. So he was a TV star. And then he did, only a couple of movies before he did Dirty Dancing, and then he became a movie star. So my big brother was a star in just about everything he'd ever done since I could remember.
Well, you know, one of the things your brother did that I loved, and this is probably going to sound strange, but, you know, I've seen him in all of his movies, and of course, you know, he was a huge star, and he was everywhere. But he did he was a guest host on Saturday Night Live once.
And
I laughed just thinking about that.
I still laugh thinking about it. You know, I'm an avid skydiver, and I was up in Arizona, actually out in the middle of the desert, sleeping in my tent, and we were doing these formation skydives, and there was about 300 skydivers camping out in the desert next to this little airstrip. And my brother was on Saturday Night Live, so I had to hop on my motorcycle, and I drove about 100 miles just so I could rent a motel just to watch him on Saturday Night Live. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was on my way back to my tent.
But, well, when you watch that episode, Don, you had to be thinking, well, he did not disappoint, because he was so funny, dude.
Well, everyone was so surprised that he would have such irreverent humor, but, you know, I'd seen him growing up, so I knew he was capable of it.
Well, you know, when I saw him...
He held his own with Chris Farley and the Chippendales dance scene.
Yeah, those guys were just... Yeah, you know, it was like, you know, because, like, you know, Patrick Swayze is a huge star, and, you know, like, what are they going to do? And usually they treat, you know, the big stars with kid gloves. But, you know, your brother was just like, you know, like he was one of the crew. He was just like, hey, let's do this, you know?
He was up for anything they dished out.
Yeah, anyway, I've always remembered that, you know? I mean, of course, everybody, you know, remembers him, you know, in Ghost and Dirty Dancing. And he did a great movie called City of Hope that was just, you know, phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. That was actually one of his favorites. So thank you for bringing that up, yeah.
Oh, it was just a beautiful movie.
Yeah, it was.
So now, let's talk about Heathens and Thieves.
All right.
Now,
Thieves and Thieves.
What's your character in it? What's your character's name?
Okay, well, I'm Colonel Sherman Rutherford, a retired colonel from the United States Army, just after the Civil War, and I was a commander of an infantry division in Ohio. But now, after the war, I've turned into a mercenary, and I'm working for a banker in New Hampshire. And there's been a shipment of gold out in California that's been stolen, and it's been rumored that it was stolen by this Chinese man who had worked for the railroad. And all they know is that he had quit working for the railroad, and now he bought a ranch somewhere up in Northern California. So I'm out to investigate. And, I, of course, I'm a pretty unsavory character, if you will, and I've got a couple of banditos that I've hired, local guys as security, and then sure enough, the other people have, other lecherous souls have heard about this stolen gold, so there's all kinds of bad guys, and that's why it's called Heathens and Thieves. There's no good guys in the entire movie. But I'm the baddest of the bad. It's one of the biggest and best roles I've ever had, and even though it's a villain, I brought a lot of humor and charm to this character. I mean, we started shooting before my brother passed away, and then... and then there was a break in the shooting because they wanted to wait to do some of the exteriors when the fall had come. And then, damn it, I lost my brother right in the middle of it. And then I had to go back and go back to work shooting this film. So, in a way, there was enough heaviness in my real life. So when I showed up on the set, I brought a lot of humor to this character I've always been pretty good at comedy, but just the blend and the ability to go to this set and forget for a few hours a day. It was very, very important to me. And out of it came this amazing character. So I'm getting a lot of recognition for it. And it's doing well at the local, at the LA Downtown Film Festival a couple of weeks ago. It won the Audience Choice Award in Houston. It won, won the Jury Award for Best Picture in Houston. And one of the actresses, she won Best Actress for it there. And then we won Best Picture in Sacramento, so it's only been to 4 film festivals, and it's done really well, so I'm hoping that it does a lot more, and I've got 3 more films in post-production ready to come out over the next few months after that, so it's a exciting time for me. And I've been doing it 29 years, but these past 2 years have been 2 of the best.
Do you prefer the dark characters or comedy, or are you adept at comedy?
I've done a few comedies. Matter of fact, I just did an episode of Wilfred on FX that just played about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and all the blogs and all the message boards, all the people are coming on saying how hilarious my episode was. They want me back for a regular character. And again, that was directed me in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, a great show.
Yeah.
And
comedy.
Do you Now, we know your brother was a great dancer. Are you a dancer as well? Are you the one that taught him the moves?
No, my mom. We grew up in a dance family. My mom's a choreographer, and she was artistic director of the Houston Jazz and Ballet Company. And I mean, she was head of the dance department at the University of Houston for 18 years. She was head of the Texas Arts Committee, started the High School for Performing and Visual Arts in Houston, and she was really big in the dance world in Texas. So that was our background, and that's why Patrick and I have managed to do a lot of the stunt work involved with the acting roles we've had. And my brother was famous for doing all his own stunts, like in Roadhouse, diving off that embankment on top of the guy on the motorcycle. He did, that's clearly him doing it. And he did a lot of things that they would generally never let an actor do, but it comes from dance. It comes from having the dance background.
Yeah, I when you talked about that scene, I remember that. I think everyone I know has seen Roadhouse at least 5 times. it's just a great movie.
Well, it's after Dirty Dancing, was the one where all the girls drugged their boyfriends to the chick flick, and the guys had to sit there. And then, a lot of them went, wow, okay, this guy's pretty good, but, what else can he do? Then the very next movie, Roadhouse, the guys were dragging the girlfriend there to see this Hellraiser movie, and all the guys, the same boyfriends in that same generation, were going, all right. So my brother was literally a ladies' man and a man's man, and he did it, and he proved it in two back-to-back movies, and I think that's why people liked him so much.
Yeah, he was a very good actor, you know, very personable.
Well, a wonderful actor and a good guy and just a really sweet, good person, and everybody on the set always loved hanging out with my brother. Good guy.
Well, you know, you've worked with a lot of people in your career, Don. Is there somebody that you haven't worked with that you'd like to work with, whether it be actor, director, producer?
Oh, God. I mean, everybody says it's almost cliche. You know, I'm still waiting for Spielberg to call. But truthfully, I would love to be on a Clint Eastwood movie, because I think, you know, he would get me. And I'd like to work with Ron Howard. And, I want to work with them all. I mean, I'm just getting started in a lot of ways. I've been doing this 29 years, and I'm still just as excited about my next job as ever. So.
Well, that's the way you got to keep it going, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm not an actor, so I never, you know, got to go on the sets of, movies or see how you guys work. And I imagine it's a lot of fun. But is it a lot of fun, or is it just like a lot of work? Or do you guys are saying things like, you know, everybody thinks it's all fun and games, but man, this is a lot of work?
Well, it depends. A lot of times there's just a lot of waiting in the trailer, and it can be pretty tedious. So you got to, you know, people bring their guitar, bring, you know, a book. Or when I worked on True Blood, it was very busy in that they would, like, I was one of the werewolves. And on this particular day, it would be like Werewolf Day. They had set aside all the scenes for all the werewolf scenes all on one day. So I never went back to the trailer. I was on the set from morning till night. And then you go on to do a feature film out in, like, the Western that I did, Heathens and Thieves, and you got to split the time. I mean, I might be on the set, you know, one day, and then I might be off for two, and then I'm on for 2 days, and I'm off for 3 days, and so you got to be able to, find things to do. I'm an avid cyclist, so I always take, stuck my bicycle on the property, on the prop truck,
uh-huh,
and had it shipped up with me, so that's what I did. Shot a film up in Snohomish, Washington. We were actually based out of Everett, Washington. I was skydiving down in Sheridan, Oregon, and in Malala. Went up to British Columbia skydiving. So yeah, I find my.
Well, also skydiving sounds like it's your passion. Skydiving and cycling. No wonder you're in such great shape.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know what, Don? It's been great talking with you, and I want to encourage everybody to go out and see the movie Heathens and Thieves. And
thank you.
They can find more information about Don Swayze. You can find it on justimagineinc.com, and of course, you can go onto Don's website, which is donswayze.com. Is that correct?
There's a donswayze.com and .net, which is the same thing. And it's not really. It's just basically pictures and a couple of pictures and a resume, and then it shows a sizzle reel where you can watch a little bit of Heathens and Thieves. But I'm going to be updating my website here shortly.
Great. Okay. We've been talking to Don Swayze, movie star, television star. And thank you so much, Don, for being on today.
And thank you.
We'd love to have you come out here to Ashland, Oregon, for our International Film Festival, and bring Heathens and Thieves with you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd love to bring it.
All right. Thank you.
To learn more about Don Swayze, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Scott Latzer's new book, Say Nice Things About Detroit, describes the Midwest city to a national audience. He spoke about it with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
What a cool dude.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we're privileged to have on author Scott Latzer. He's the author of four novels, Battle Creek, All I Could Get, The Year That Follows, and his new novel, Say Nice Things About Detroit. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Hey, I had the honor of reading your book, and I really, really liked it. And I understand that you guys are going to be possibly making a movie out of this?
You know, always an exciting possibility. Yeah, the book sold the movies, and I was hired along with a writing partner to write the screenplay, which we have recently turned in. So, you know, it's one of those things that is, as they say in the business, in development. That certainly is alive and ticking, and, you know, we're hoping for the best.
Great. Well, you know, I'd love to see it turn into a movie. And you recently had a book signing there in Detroit. How did that go?
Yeah, I had actually four in Michigan last week, and they were all, you know, I got to say, they were all great. And it was great to be back. You know, the place is, it's needless to say, it's a very interesting place, and I think it's changing very rapidly, you know, at the moment. So both of those things made it a really interesting week.
Yeah, I bet. And, yeah, Detroit seems to be, like, on a rebound.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, you know, put in a note, it's sort of going through a death and a rebirth at exactly the same moment. I mean, there's, you know, the big thing that about Detroit you have to understand is just where it was and where it is. So, you know, it hit its peak population in 1950 when it was really probably the center of the American economy. And since then, it's lost a million people, which hasn't happened in any other city. I mean, the statistics are unbelievable. There are more people who have left Detroit than currently live in San Francisco.
Oh, wow. You know,
the amount of empty space within Detroit is greater than the entire city of Boston. So it's this place that's been very much hollowed out. And, you know, I think sort of we're at an inflection point where it's sort of gotten so, in a way, it's gotten so bad that you can start over. And I think that's really what's happening. You're seeing neighborhoods come back to life. There are actually young people moving into Detroit. The way I'd phrase it is there really isn't a frontier anymore in the United States, or if there is one, it's in places like Detroit. You know, there's something that you can go to you can go there and be a pioneer in a way that you can't just move west the way it was, say, 100 years ago.
Yeah, you know, that's a good analogy. It's kind of like you can go there and, you know, settle the town all over again.
You can completely start over again. I was at the Tiger game, that's a baseball team, and we went to the Tiger game on Friday, and we parked in this parking garage that used to be a ballroom. So there's, if you look up, there's this incredibly ornate ceiling, beautiful old ceiling from probably 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and yet now they're using that building to park cars. I mean, there's just no other place like it in the United States. It's fantastic, really.
Yeah, you know, it really does sound fantastic, and, you know, I've been there, but not recently. Does it help the city any that the Detroit Tigers, the baseball team, is in first place, and that the Detroit Lions have had the best season?
Yeah, if you're a Detroit fan, you are a long-suffering fan. I mean, I think Detroit's a tough town, and one of the things that makes it tough is the sports teams. You know, the last time the Lions won a championship was 1957. I mean, in other words, I've been a Detroit Lions fan my whole life, and they've never won a championship. I mean, I think it does help. I mean, the energy of the stadium, that Justin Verlander, who is, you know, for my money, the best pitcher in baseball, was pitching that night. They were playing the White Sox, who at the time were in first place. The Tigers have since overtaken them. And you know, there was just a lot of electricity. I do think that that helps. But I think that it's more than that. I think it's really just that there's a, you know, sort of a camaraderie of shared suffering in Detroit. And that's among Detroiters and all. Detroiters of all stripes, including those who don't live there. I think if you look at the statistics, it's likely that there are more Detroiters who have moved away than who actually live in the city. So there's this huge population of Detroiters who live, you know, all over the country and all over the world. And I think they're also rooting for the place, too. So I feel there's a spirit about the place that hasn't been there before. I mean, there's still really tough problems in Detroit and very tough areas. And, I was in a number of them last week. You drive down neighborhoods where, you know, one to two out of every three houses is empty, you know, just a shell of a house. It's actually pretty sad. And there's this, you know,
the city's trying to tear down these vacant structures, and there's so many of them. They're years and years behind. I don't want to make it sound like it's some paradise. It is still a tough place, but it's undergoing this kind of change that I think we've all been waiting for. But it just, you know, they built the big buildings downtown in Detroit right on the river called the Renaissance Center.
Uh-huh.
Those were supposed to be the Renaissance for Detroit, and those were built in the 70s. Okay, so, you know, Detroit's been waiting for this rebirth for decades. Maybe now it's upon us.
Now that your book is out, maybe things will turn around for the city. It sounds like everything's going in the right direction.
There's been a lot of pressure on the book there. The book is really just supposed to be a good and entertaining story.
It is a good and entertaining story. I don't think I put in any undue pressure on there, Scott.
Well, let's just put it this way. I don't think anybody wants to be responsible for turning around Detroit because it's a Herculean task. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that what the book does is that it shows that life can be lived there. And as you know from the book, it doesn't do with any kind of yellow tint. I mean, there's a double murder on the first page.
Right.
I mean, the story I'd like to think is a realistic depiction of what life is like in Detroit. But merely saying that there is life in Detroit is somewhat different from what you get on the national news, where you would think that life couldn't be lived there at all.
Well, you know, I think, you know, that Detroit, you know, first of all, you know, your book is very, very entertaining, and I highly recommend it to everyone. It's a good read. And, you know, as far as Detroit goes, I think that they're going to have a barn burner year. You know, Mitt Romney gets elected president of the United States will be from Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things for the country, and without trying to get too political about it, but both candidates running this time are from the Midwest.
Right, Chicago and Detroit.
Which is unusual. I mean, usually, you know, up until, I mean, from Kennedy until Obama, every president who was elected was either from California or from the South. And I'd argue that the country's better served by having some Midwesterners in there, but I realize I'm a Midwesterner, so I feel that way. You know, obviously, both these men have moved around. I mean, Obama actually chose the Midwest to live, whereas Romney left it. So, you know, who's the more better Midwesterner? It's hard to say. I mean, my mother knew one of Romney's older sisters. I mean, Detroit, in a weird way, is kind of a small town, you know?
Uh-huh.
Apparently, the old Romney house has fallen into disrepair. I think your listeners may not know is that Romney's father was a major player in the auto industry, ultimately became the head of American Motors Corporation, which has since been bought by Chrysler. And he was also the governor of Michigan and was really the front runner for the Republican nomination for president in 68 until Nixon beat him.
You know,
he comes from a old line, well-connected Michigan family.
About your book now, what possessed you to write it in the first place?
Well, you know, I wanted to write a book about Detroit, and you know, I like stories that take place in settings where they can only take place in that setting, and I felt that this book especially gave me the opportunity to write something like that. You know, I've been Detroit's been sort of in all my books, but never taken as a head-on subject, and I think maybe I got old enough and maybe removed enough from it, and things got bad enough in Detroit where I just couldn't ignore it anymore. I mean, stories about trouble, and it's hard to think of a place with more trouble than Detroit. And, you know, the distance, I think, also helped, too, that I wasn't living there. I think sometimes it's hard for the fish to see the water, and you get out a little bit, and you get, in many ways, a clearer view.
Right.
I went back a lot, and I continue to go back a lot. I feel like there's... I mean, I think there's really a dearth of novels set in Detroit. There just aren't that many, and I think there need to be more, and I feel like I would like to write another one. I don't know what it's going to be yet, and I'm working on a book now that's not set there, but I know there'll be another one in the future. I think the subject is too vast and for there not to be more, and I think it's, again, I'll just go back, it's very unusual how few books are set there. I mean, Elmore Leonard has written several. Jeff Eugenides in Middlesex is very much a novel about Detroit, as well as A Hermaphrodite. And I'm reading a writer right now named Gary Hardwick who writes mystery or crime novel set there. But there is really, I'm surprised there aren't more.
No, well, you know, and maybe you can be the author that brings it to fruition. Because when you said that, it was such an interesting comment because, you know, I instantly flashed on, you know, books that are like... There was a author, Lawrence Sanders, and all his books were set in Miami. and down in the Keys. And I think Carl Heisen is also, he writes for Miami.
I was going to mention Heisen, exactly. Yeah, and or, you know, there are, and the other thing I'd say about this, because I got this question in an interview, I think it was yesterday, the day before, about, you know, should there be more regional books? And I'm like, well, what makes my book regional? I mean, regionalism, all novels especially take place in a certain place or places, and they need to be specific about that place. You know, I would use a novel like, say, Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. Nobody called that a regional novel. I mean, I think that there was, I'm not sure that that book ever left New York City. If it did, it was very brief, like out to the Hamptons or something. So it's basically really a novel of New York, but somehow that's not regional. And I would just argue that regionalism tends to be a term of condescension from the coast. You know, they're looking down on things that happen elsewhere. I guess Faulkner's a regional writer, and you know, William Kennedy writes so brilliantly about Albany. I just reject the whole term. I think that the good novelists write well about place, and all places are important.
All places are important, but you know, like you know, well, listening to your books, I listened to your book on the audio version,
mm-hmm.
and also read it, and. You know, your book, I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, the whole time, you know, you're reading your book, you're like, you're in Detroit. You know, you feel like you know the city.
Yeah, well, I very much wanted it to be, you know, I wanted people to experience the city the way I experience. So it's not just, it's all five senses, not just sight. It looks a certain way, you know, at different seasons. It smells a different way. It sounds, you know, there are different sounds. I mean, you know, like there's those Chrysler commercials you see on TV now of, and when I first saw the first one, the imported from Detroit commercials, I saw the first one, it was a car driving down the street, and I immediately said, that's Detroit. And I didn't, there was no landmark I could tell by the light. You know, there was just the look of the place, and immediately I got it. And I sort of wanted to portray that in a book. You know, other things too, like Detroit music, I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out why I'm so proud of this place, and I can't really explain it, but I think the music is part of it. A few days ago, I was actually in the old Motown building of Berry Gordy's house on West Grand Boulevard. And at the end of the, took this little tour, and at the end of the tour, we ended up in Studio A, as it's called, which is where all those Motown hits were recorded. And it was really just Berry Gordy's garage. It was a converted garage, literally. And not very nice. I mean, you know, so much shabby. And you stand in that room, and you think all the music that's come out of there, it's pretty amazing. So
yeah, and all the people, all the different artists, you know, just a flood of different artists came to mind.
Some people you wouldn't necessarily, you know, even associate with the city, like, say, Glenn Frey of the Eagles. I mean, I don't think of the Eagles as a Detroit band, but, you know, they do have that, you know, they have that guy who grew up there. So anyway, you know, I just felt like I wanted to get the real feeling of the place because, in many ways, I never read about it. You know, I read a lot of books, and it's just not there. So this gave me an opportunity to do something about that.
Well, we're glad that you did, and we're glad that you came on, and we really look forward to seeing the movie.
Hey, so do I.
I'm sure it will come out. All right, everybody, we've been talking with Scott Lesser. And he's the author of Say Nice Things About Detroit. Go out and pick up a copy. You can get it at... well, everywhere fine books are sold. I'm sure it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I know that it's available as an audiobook through Blackstone Audio. And it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
To learn more about Scott Lesser, visit us on our website at
justimagineitinc.com.
A girl with a wicked mind, but everything looks better when the sun goes down. I had everything, opportunities for eternity, and I could belong to the night. Your eyes, I can see in your eyes, you make me wanna die.
John Dodds, who lives in Europe and listens to Get Behind Me Now, Stay There regularly, is also the author of The Kendrick Chronicles, a gritty Scottish crime thriller featuring a very different kind of serial killer. They suffer for his art. When a number of women are reported missing in Glasgow, the specter of a previous spat of unsolved disappearances in the city rears its ugly head. Journalist Ray Bissett is drawn to the case when his daughter joins the ranks of the missing. Ambitious police detective Tom Kendrick won't let Ray forget a terrible incident from his past that resulted in the death of a young boy. Damaged lives and dark secrets. The streets of Glasgow are haunted by the ghost of the missing and an artist driven by a deadly inspiration.
We could dump them, you know, Stephen offered after another couple of drinks. Jane watched her sister, Paula, and her friend, Evelyn, wrapped up in two men who were chatting them up at the bar. One had Evelyn pressed up against him, a hand clamped on her buttock, while the other hand raised and lowered a beer. The other one, a man of perhaps 25, was making Paula giggle and play with the ends of her hair. Stephen said, "It's going to be some party, like nothing you've ever seen before."
"Yeah?"
"Champagne, caviar, probably. A few celebs knocking about. There always are at Peter's." This was a name Stephen invented on the hoof. "Like last time I went to one of his bashes a couple of weeks back, you'll never guess who was there."
"Who?"
asked Jane, eyes widening. "Ted Austin."
"You're joking?"
Jane exclaiming, completely believing. Ted Austin was the current teenage heartthrob from an Australian soap opera who happened to be in the city performing in pantomime, a fact that Jane was sure to be aware of. "He might even be there tonight." He paused, struck by a thought, and added, "I bet he would really like you, Jane." Oh, he was good. Even without the naivety and alcohol, young Jane would have eaten all of this up. Glamour, the promise of it, and the excitement that went with it raised her out of whatever ordinariness she inhabited. Sprays of disco lights moved across the booth, fleetingly catching the blush in her cheeks, the modest lowering of the eyes. He was truly a master of the game. By the time Evelyn and Paula returned and started looking around for them, Stephen and young Jane Larson were long gone from the club.
John Dodds, featured on episode 6 of Get Behind Me, Not Stay There, is a Scottish writer, best known for his crime, horror, and fantasy fiction. In addition to his novels Bone Machines and Kaylee's Kiss, he has published numerous short stories, three of them receiving honorable mention in the year's Best Fantasy and Horror Anthology series. He currently resides in Bulgaria, where he's working on the third installment of the Kendrick Chronicles. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to blackstoneaudio.com or visit them at downpour.com.
For you, the listeners of the Get Behind Me Now, Stay There podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. To give you the opportunity to check out their service by going to audibletrial.com/imagine. Here are some of our favorites. Of course, you can get whatever you want. Remember to go to audibletrial.com/imagine for these wonderful titles. 50 Shades of Grey, Book 1 of the 50 Shades Trilogy, unabridged by E.L. James. Gone Girl, a novel, unabridged by Gillian Flynn. Odd Apocalypse, an Odd Thomas novel, Book 5 by Dean Koontz. 50 Shades Darker, Book 2 of the 50 Shades Trilogy, unabridged by E.L. James. And The Hunger Games, unabridged by Susan Collins.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her head. I hear the sound of a church on the wind that blows her perfume through the air. I'm picking up.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Cyrus Emerson.
I'm Maya Seligman.
And I'm Lucy Sherman. And I'm Charlie Stanton. And we want to thank you all for listening to us all around the world. We really have a beautiful time making this show, and it's a lot of fun, and we're so glad that so many people are enjoying it. We do want to mention that Lucy Sherman, she had an unfortunate bicycle accident while she was in her BMX racing in downtown streets of Ashland. So get well, Lucia, and we look forward to doing another show with you soon. So just remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.